Hello, welcome back to our Torts podcast, which is recorded here in the traditional lands of Tecumseh Te Sequeknek in Sequeknek Ulu. This is part one of two of our interview with Rosemary Anderson and her lawyer, Sandy Kovacs. Enjoy! Hi, everybody. So we are here today and we're really fortunate and really, really happy to be able to interview Sandy Kovacs and Rosemary Anderson. Sandy is a lawyer and Rosemary is her client, and they were involved in a really important, significant case that came out in the fall. And we'll get into all of that, and I will post the case so that you can read it if you want to. To start things off, maybe Sandy and Rosemary, could you give us a brief introduction to yourselves? Maybe Rosemary, could we start with you? So who you are and where you are today and what a sort of brief introduction to why we're here.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for this opportunity. I'm really, really stoked to be able to do this.
We're really happy to have you.
Besides the fact that I want to learn how to do a podcast. So
you know what? It's pretty easy. It's probably hard to do it well, but it's pretty easy to do it, you know, okay.
That's awesome. So the reason why I got to know Sandy Kovacs, which is a wonderful outcome, but the reason was not so wonderful. Mm-hmm. When I was 26 years old, my father died on the last day of July of 1976, and on the Labor Day weekend, about 5 weeks later, I started a new job in a new town, which was Kamloops, and they didn't know anybody there at all, and of course, I was grief-stricken. I was hired to teach at OLPH Elementary School, and that is right across the parking lot from the church, OLPH Church, and the bishop's residence, and separately the residence of the two priests who were there at the time. And I got to know those priests. They were basically the only people I got to know besides the chairperson of our school committee. I had no opportunity to make friends before I was assaulted by the co-pastor, and then, of course, I wasn't going to make friends. So what happened was this, I thought this must be my fault. I didn't know how to stop it, and it went on for many months before I finally figured out that I could go and speak to the bishop, and ultimately that put an end to it, not immediately, but ultimately. So fast forward 40 years, and this has been affecting me all that time without my realizing it particularly, but I certainly hadn't forgotten about the abuse. And I started to have flashbacks and to be triggered a lot. I still was going to church. I was triggered constantly. Don't know why I still went, but I did. And eventually I reached out to the church in Kamloops, to the bishop. The response came from essentially from a lawyer. They immediately told me I couldn't talk to anybody but a lawyer or with a lawyer present. I thought that lawyer was for me. And after a couple of conversations where I spilled my guts with him, I found out that he was representing the Diocese of Kamloops. So that's
wow,
sort of it in a
that's
nutshell.
Incredible.
It was incredible. It was devastating. And so I said to him, well, you know, this is another example of a power imbalance. I guess I need to have a lawyer. But all I wanted to do was to have, to have some closure to this, to have some, I began to realize that this wasn't all my fault. I still thought it was somewhat my fault. And over the, and eventually I discovered Sandy and learned over time with therapy and everything else over the past 5 years that it wasn't my fault. And but I knew always, of course, that it was not a consensual relationship. I still thought it was my fault. And
I think that's
because
very
after
common.
All, the perpetrator was a priest. He couldn't do any wrong. So, yeah. So we ended up in court because of the pushback from the church was, I would say, relentless. That's my experience of it. And so, we ended up in trial. It just, I'll let Sandy explain that better.
That's an amazing story. And I have to say, Rosemary, I mean, I was thinking about the questions to ask, and I actually sort of felt bad about asking you to talk about this, because I know that it must not be an easy thing to talk about. But I also know, because I heard the two of you interviewed on CBC and I had heard you tell your story, so I already had kind of like a glimpse of just what a strong person you are. Like, you are one brave woman, and I know that you're capable of talking about this, but it must not be easy. I'm pretty stunned. I don't think I had heard before that this happened with the lawyer for the diocese. So this person, it sounds like, had let you believe that the lawyer was representing you.
Well, that's a bit of a longer story, but but it was, you know, there's even a paper trail to show why I thought that. However, it was I'd like to be able to say it was an innocent mistake, but I don't think it's ever innocent for a lawyer to talk to somebody and not introduce themselves as, I'm so-and-so and I'm representing so-and-so.
Well, I think it's, you know, not super ethical.
But yeah, it may not be strictly prohibited, but it's still not good practice.
Yeah, that's very concerning.
Exactly. Now, this was not the lawyer who we encountered in trial. This was someone else from the same firm.
Right. Well, that's another part of the story that I wasn't aware of before, which is upsetting. Maybe, Sandy, could we go to you and just have a quick introduction?
Sure. First of all, I would echo your comment that Rosemary is, quote unquote, one brave woman. She certainly is, and she's very inspiring in having pursued this case as far as she did. You know, just by way of background, I'm a personal injury lawyer in Vancouver, and I also teach the personal injury course at UBC Law. And, you know, I was fortunate because I haven't always been on the plaintiff side. I worked on the defense side for over a decade. And in October of 2016, I switched sides. And I was fortunate because Rosemary found me about 2 months after I switched sides, and I was a fish out of water. But I think she found me on LinkedIn, and we met.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we met and, you know, I sort of switched sides to do a bit of motor vehicle and sort of some basic personal injury. But I was keen to take on her case because I thought it was a meaningful case. I thought it could push the boundaries of the law as it stood. And I also have a personal interest in these cases as well, because I am a survivor of abuse myself, not in the clergy context, but in a different context. But I understand these claims, and I am very keen to advance the law in this area of practice.
That's really incredible. That's also something I didn't know, and I have a lot of respect for the courage of talking about that as well. Maybe it would be a good time to go on to talk a bit about the case and, you know, legally, what were the claims and what happened and what the judge decided. I think that's probably one for you, Sandy.
You know, it was a slow start to the case, and it was an interesting start. I think at the beginning, I remember Rosemary mentioning that she actually didn't know the priest's last name before we sort of got started and before she started digging into this. And so, you know, we knew the priest's last name by the time she came to me. And we, of course, knew that the diocese was involved. And, of course, you know, the action as against the priest, who we learned was still alive in Ontario, is an assault and battery, and arguing that there was no consent in that relationship, nor could there possibly be. And historically, that's been called vitiated consent. It was interesting because in the course of the trial, our trial judge did say that perhaps that term needs to be retired, because it suggests there
it's
is consent.
It's just not consent.
Yes, it's just not consent.
Yeah.
But the claim was founded in assault and battery, the torts of assault and battery, which are intentional torts. But what we knew as well is that a priest was unlikely to have any significant assets, if at all. And of course, we bring civil litigation because we're seeking compensation, and it's expensive to bring litigation. And so you want to ensure that, of course, there is some recovery of the judgment at the end of the day. And in the usual course, it's not only the perpetrator in these circumstances that needs to be held accountable, but it's the system, it's the institution. And so the church is actually organized geographically and corporately into various diocesan corporations. And so we sued the Diocese of Kamloops, which is the corporate entity that employed the priest at the time. But the interesting thing is that this priest was reportedly lacking capacity, and neither the Diocese of Kamloops nor the Diocese of Kingston or the Archdiocese of Kingston, where he'd been ministering for a couple of decades at least, would take responsibility for him. And so there was significant delay at the beginning of the case in that regard, because we were looking to have him assessed in some way and have someone appear for him. And until he appeared, the diocese was not wanting to respond or appear on the record either. And so there was delay in filing their response. And ultimately what Rosemary did is she paid out of her own pocket to compel the Ontario Public Guardian and Trustee to do that capacity assessment and to file the response, which was disappointing because, and I think Rosemary could speak to this piece a little bit more before I return to the chronology, but you know, the church had benefited or not benefited, I guess, from this priest's ministry for decades, and yet they washed their hands of him as soon as we brought this litigation.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I found it something that my students who are, you know, just a couple of months into learning tort law really struggle with, is the idea that we've got lots of cases where a person did something wrong and the plaintiff is suing, you know, a government authority or an employer or something like that. And I think I've had conversations with some students where they find it frustrating because they're like, why isn't the law about the person who did the wrong thing? And the fact that, you know, there's no point suing unless there's some money and assets there, I think for some people they find that sort of frustrating and like a cynical way of looking at the world. But the point you make is really important, that the system, the accountability of the system matters too. Individuals do things that are harmful, but they do it in the context of a system that needs oversight and accountability. So I like that. I hadn't thought of sort of explaining it to people that way, but I think it's really helpful.
Well, it's a public policy issue as well. I mean, we impose vicarious liability on institutions that have responsibility for the individual's conduct because they have the ability to change their policy to deter that conduct.
Yeah.
And so there is a public policy rationale to it. But the reality of the civil justice system is that it is about money, and the criminal justice system is not. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll get to sort of the deficiencies of each system later. But I think there's a very real public policy rationale to vicarious liability. But in this case, of course, we didn't just have vicarious liability. We had direct negligence, which was causative of the injury. But I thought perhaps Rosemary might want to comment on sort of the steps we had to take with the Ontario Public Guardian Trustee, because I know that that became a very sensitive and sore issue for her.
Yeah, indeed it was and still is. So what the fact that the church in Kamloops, neither the church in Kamloops nor the church in Kingston, where this person was taking any responsibility or even really responding. In fact, they, as Sandy experienced, a great resistance to responding from Kingston. That shocked me because at that stage, and this was 2017. This was early 2017 by now. I still had the idea that the church cared and that they just didn't quite get it.
Right.
And
I mean, so that's a reasonable thing to think about the church, you would think.
You'd think so. But
yeah.
So thinking that they cared and experiencing their pushback to me, I was even more shocked that they were as I would describe it, leaving one of their own hanging out to dry. They basically hung him out to dry. Mm-hmm. But that was, of course, my perception. That's mm-hmm. not really what was happening. What they were really doing was just avoiding the issue in whatever way they could, through whatever loophole they could crawl. Right. It was absolutely a re-victimization, a re-abuse. There was no two ways about it. It profoundly impacted me, and the ongoing pushback from the church has profoundly impacted me. However, having said that, there have been a lot of really good things about the process, and we can talk to that maybe later. I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at, Sandy, but I mean, it was extraordinary to me. It's just mind-boggling that I had to pay for it instead of them. I just didn't get that, and I still don't get that, and I really want them to, I really do want the Diocese of Kamloops to acknowledge, and they haven't yet done so in words, but maybe they will. I'm hopeful that they will, to acknowledge that that was just plain morally wrong, because it was.
Well, and I think, you know, what's interesting is, you know, the church foisting the responsibility for Father Molin onto the Ontario taxpayer. I found that a bit surprising, to say the least. But, you know, yeah, shocking. So, but, you know, thereafter, I mean, it just seemed that we were facing a lot of delay at the beginning. And that's, you know, not altogether unusual. I mean, council are busy, pleadings need to be filed, and document disclosure needs to happen. And the initial stage of document disclosure, we did receive quite a few documents. But one of the things I look for in these cases are not just what we've received, but what we haven't received. We look for the gaps. And, you know, there was a gap in documentation produced for the pertinent year in question, which was 1976. So document disclosure became a really big focus in this case. And we worked with an expert, Tom Doyle, who is an ordained priest in the U.S. He's a canon law expert. He's got a pontifical doctorate in it. And he was one of the original whistleblowers within the Roman Catholic Church in the 1980s. And Rosemary had actually tipped me off to him, and he's become a great resource to me ever since we started this case. But he, you know, he used to work at what is the equivalent of the Washington Embassy for the Vatican. And so he had inside knowledge in terms of document disclosure and how that works within the church. And he's worked globally on numerous inquiries and grand jury investigations, et cetera. But he prepared a report for us that basically said, look, every diocese is required under canon law, which is the church's internal legal system, to have a secret archive. And so we really sought to. Yeah. It sounds very Da Vinci Code-ish, but it's
us. Yeah.
You know, and the diocese kept denying that they had it. And we served, I sort of tried to make a pseudo Anton Piller order, which was interesting because, you know, ultimately we didn't proceed with it, but it was just a matter of pushing the church for disclosure.
Could you explain what that is? Because our one else don't know.
Well, it's basically, you know, an order where we get to go in and do a forensic audit of what's on site. And, you know, civilly, it was a bit difficult because, you know, I wanted to go on site and see what was there. And, you know, I mean, I've heard of reports in the U.S. and certain diocesan entities, you know, holding documents in the broom closet, and authorities would find
them
there.
Wow. So, it's so cloak and dagger.
It is. And you know, to be fair to this diocese, and perhaps we'll never know, I mean, they insisted time and time again that they had disclosed everything that they could disclose. And to be fair, there were some incriminating documents that supported our claim of direct negligence that the bishop knew. But it was a lot of vague references to that information and to that knowledge, which persisted throughout the trial as well. But the, you know, I was actually invited to go up, and I actually did sit in the bishop's rectory and looked through some of the documents that were made available for my review. But the reality is I knew when I went up there, it's not like I was going to be invited to look through every nook and cranny, nor did I have the time to do that. But document disclosure was a big issue in this case. And one of the things we did between our trial sittings, because it became apparent when we were cross-examining Archbishop Exner, that that some minutes had been produced from some council meetings that had happened at the material time. And what we learned is that there were different councils for different purposes. There was a presbyteral council, there was a diocesan council, and there's also a priestly consultant council. And what we learned is that we were missing certain documents. And so in between the trial, I had actually made a document application and also served it on the Papal Nuncio in Ottawa, which is basically the Vatican's embassy to Canada. And we did that largely to prove a point, because the Vatican has said time and time again that they are prepared to cooperate with civil authorities and to be forthright with their document and information disclosure. Yet when I served the embassy in Ottawa, the Papal Nuncio, they basically refused to participate and communicated through defense counsel for the diocese, who, by the way, had insisted that this was just a small lawsuit against the little old Bishop of Kamloops, but now he's basically communicating on behalf of the Pope. But they actually hid behind the Vienna Convention and said that they had diplomatic immunity and would not cooperate. Yeah, they wouldn't provide any documents. And in fact, they never appeared to the application.
So really, like, any technicality that they can find.
Huh. Yeah, and we know that they have documents there. And one of the interesting things is recently the Vatican's report on McCarrick came out. Now, he's a disgraced cardinal from the U.S.
Yeah.
But in that document, they reference having reviewed documents at the nunciature in Washington State. So we know that these nunciatures actually hold documents, that they have archives. You know, I think it's interesting with the PR coming out of the church that they say they want to cooperate, but then when push comes to shove, they don't. And that was the point in bringing that application, you know, to demonstrate to the court, look, you know, we know there are more documents out there. They're not cooperating. And I was also able to demonstrate to the court that this case wasn't just about the little old Bishop of Kamloops. It was bigger than that.
Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, picking up on what Rosemary said, it's... Maybe you expect sort of some of that kind of resistance in civil litigation, but it's a different complexion when it's an institution that is supposed to be in a pastoral position of care with people. It's sort of those two things don't fit together very well.
No, that's true. And I thought maybe I'd answer the last component of your question, the trial judgment, what it means and how it's significant to Canadian tort law. You know, Terneuzen and Korn had been decided some years ago, and that was a situation in which a patient was exploited by her physician. And so the fiduciary relationship was observed in that case. But to my knowledge, in Canada, there was no action that actually went to trial involving an adult abuse victim of a clergy person within the context of the Roman Catholic Church. We know it happens, and in fact, I think there's some research that Rosemary found out of Australia that suggests the incidence of adult abuse by clergy is about five times that of child abuse.
That's amazing. I was not aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Kind of and Rosemary can maybe speak to some of that research as well, but the incidence of it is significant, yet people don't come forward. And perhaps for the reasons Rosemary explained earlier. I mean, she blamed herself for a long time. And I think that's reinforced by the church as well. You know, there is I'll respectfully say, a misogynistic sort of tone to that faith. And I grew up in that faith, so I feel like I can say that. Mm-hmm. But in any event, you know, I don't think it's never been victim friendly. But in terms of the decision itself, you know, we were a little bit disappointed in the economic damages that were awarded, the pecuniary damages. When we look at tort law on the whole and personal injury cases, you know, when we're dealing with hypothetical claims for lost earning capacity, it's not meant to be a balance of probabilities. It's a real and substantial possibility test. And we thought we could do more with that. But the court did make an award acknowledging that these events did impact Rosemary's ability to earn income over time. But the big result is the direct negligence claim against the church, which we could not have achieved but for Exner's evidence. And we actually only got Exner's evidence because we subpoenaed him as an adverse witness in the plaintiff's case. And the defense was put to the choice of either standing down the plaintiff's case and calling the witness as his own, in which case the weight to the evidence was greater than if he was an adverse witness, versus us calling him as an adverse witness. And so that's how we got him there, because there was resistance to Exner appearing at the trial. But for his admissions under oath, we wouldn't have gotten that finding of direct negligence, and we certainly wouldn't have gotten the finding of punitive damages. Now, the punitive damages award in this case is significant. Of course, we have the $250,000 awarded against Molin in particular, but there's $150,000 against the church. And aside from the McLeod case in Ontario, which was a jury award of $500,000 against the church in punitive damages, this is, to my knowledge, the largest against an institution for its direct negligence in a sexual abuse situation. So that was a really significant finding in this case that I think sets a new precedent.
It sends an important message as well.
It does.
And is the defense going to appeal? Have you heard about that?
No, the appeal period has expired, and ultimately we were able to reach a resolution on some of the outstanding issues, including the institution's potential vicarious liability for the award against Molin and prejudgment interest. So there is a resolution of those issues, and the claim is now at an end.
And is there or has there been any route to the acknowledgement that Rosemary was talking about sort of acknowledging the moral wrongness?
I'm going to let Rosemary answer that one.
Okay.
So cut me off if I'm not supposed to say this, Cindy. But in the in our settlement discussions, there was mention of the bishop would be prepared to apologize to me. And it was mentioned as the Bishop of Kamloops, that is the current bishop. It was mentioned as part of the settlement, even though that's, I understand, unusual if not unique. But Sandy rightly perceived that I wouldn't want that to be a condition of our settlement. And we agreed that I wouldn't want that, and we let them know that if there was to be an apology, I wanted that to be an apology that was freely given, not an apology that was in any way coerced, such as being part of a settlement agreement. So I haven't heard anything. One of the things that has been hard on me is the fact that nobody showed up to represent the priest who was charged. Nobody showed up to represent the diocese, even, other than Archbishop Emeritus Adam Exner, who came because we subpoenaed him.
Right.
And
right.
Thank goodness we did.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't. We can see with hindsight. What we kind of felt at the time, but we can see with hindsight, we would not have had him if we hadn't done what we did. So, yeah, there hasn't been any direct apology. In fact, it's been worse than that. If you look at the press releases at the time of the announcement of the judgment, where the in particular Keith, oh my goodness, his name escapes me all of a sudden. From the Vancouver Sun Province,
Keith Fraser.
Media.
Keith Fraser. Keith Fraser.
Thank you. Keith Fraser. It's Christmas time, you know. Keith Fraser. He interviewed the then, if not now, I don't know, the then spokesperson for the diocese, who may still be, which was Scott Hugebert. And Scott Hugebert, by the way, is the one who was also speaking for the diocese, and I thought was helping me and was representing the diocese right back in the very, very beginning.
Right.
Anyways, when Keith Fraser interviewed him for his feedback on the judgment, he issued a really non-apology.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that wasn't a double negative. That was an emphatic negative.
No, I hear you.
And where he said, you know, we're very sorry for any harm we have done to anybody. And then he referenced the allegations, and it's like, what are you talking about? These are not allegations. And similarly, the BC Catholic newspaper, which I would say had to have consulted him before they wrote their little article, also referenced my case post judgment as allegations. So that's the furthest that they've come, is to acknowledge that there were allegations. And furthermore, the Archdiocese of Vancouver has started taking steps to name priests who've been abusers, sexually abusive, and they have not named this priest. Now, he was not a priest in this diocese. However, he was very active in this diocese post my abuse, not as a parish priest, but he started a group among the Filipinos that they call the Jimalani. And the Jimalani is actually an acronym for something I don't know. I don't speak Tagalog. But the Jimalani, he founded it. And he was in Vancouver a lot doing that. And he also, we learned through correspondence that he also, I don't know how much I'm supposed to say, but we learned that he also did appear in at least one church in Vancouver and serve as a priest there, at least for a brief period, perhaps, I don't know, a week or two or three, before he was discovered by the then Bishop of Vancouver and removed from that. So he's been active in Vancouver, and there's no mention of him, and I feel there should be. So I don't see how it could be any harm, because his name's been all over the place, but it could be helpful for people to realize that this is the same person that they and their children may have been interacting with.
Yes.
And by the way, he like most priests who abuse adults, most people who abuse adults, repetitively, it's extremely common. I shouldn't say most. I don't know that. But it's extremely common to find that people who are abusive of adults can be abusive of people who are not yet adults.
Mm-hmm.
And this priest was. So, you know, I wouldn't, if I were one of these families that was interacting with him closely in Vancouver, and I didn't know.
Okay, unfortunately, at this point in the interview, a fire alarm started going off in the building where Rosemary was recording. So we had to cut it off at this point and finish the interview the next day. And that's in part two. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as we did. It was just such a fascinating conversation. And there's lots more to come in part two, including a lot of thoughts from Sandy about her career as a lawyer. So it's very interesting. Join us there and listen to part two.
And